It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In the wake of Fox News settling a defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems, we take a broader view of where we're at with free speech protections and false claims. How can lies and misinformation that may imperil democracy be stopped without violating the First Amendment? Call in with your questions, your comments on free speech, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Schultz is here, distinguished professor of political science and legal studies at Hamline University, a visiting law professor at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Yes, and Catherine Ross here as well, professor at George Washington University Law School, specializing in constitutional law, specifically the First Amendment. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to get both of your reactions to this landmark defamation settlement this week, where Fox News paying more than $780 million to Dominion, the voting machine company. Catherine, you first.
It's a mixed bag. I know that many members of the public were hoping that we would have a full trial and a resolution of some of the major legal issues. We're not going to have that. On the other hand, it is not Dominion's responsibility as a private company to pursue what is in our public interest. As a business matter, it made sense for them to settle for what was a large amount of money. But to put it in perspective, the Alex Jones defamation lawsuit hit him with a bill of over $1 billion, substantially more than what Fox agreed to pay. And, for a much smaller entity, much of that, of course, may not ever be forthcoming to the plaintiffs. In addition, I'm reading from my tax colleagues that there will be an enormous tax write-off for the settlement cost, which makes it even less significant for Fox. The important First Amendment questions had to do with the current legal test and where it draws lines. And that's what many of us were hoping to see, because this was such an extraordinary case with an extraordinary fact pattern where we could have drawn some clear borders without, I think, endangering other journalistic speakers.
We are going to get to Alex Jones. I just want to mention in a bit who had portrayed the Sandy Hook massacre as a staged by crisis actor as part of gun control efforts. We'll get there. But turning to you, David, you know, what impact does this Fox News settlement have on the political coverage, on the election coverage landscape? What impact is this?
I think it's going to have less of an impact than we think. On top of the fact that the settlement from a financial point of view is less than meets the eye, it's going to be written off and so forth, I suspect, this is going to sound funny, roughly $800 million is a drop in the bucket to Fox in terms of how much money it's going to be able to make going into the 2024 news cycle, in terms of the fact that it's going to be able to more or less continue a lot of what it's been doing right now. At no point did this settlement require Fox to have to do a retraction, an on-air apology. There's really nothing in terms of saying to their viewers or to the American public, we'd lied to you and we need to make a retraction. So in some sense, it was a smart business decision for both Dominion and Fox. But as the professor pointed out, it doesn't settle the larger political issues. And I'm not sure that this serves as a significant deterrent to their behavior at Fox. But even more broadly, Fox is only the tip of the iceberg. It's the tip of the iceberg in the sense that we have a lot of falsehoods, alternative facts, lies, whatever you want to call it, that are throughout the social media that are being propagated. We have a lot of a lot of lying going on in our political system right now. And I'm not sure that what happened in the settlement here is going to do very much, if anything, to curb what I'm going to call kind of a culture of lying in our society.
A culture of lying in our society. David Schultz there at Hamline University. Catherine Ross at George Washington School of Law joining us to discuss issues around free speech and the First Amendment. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Catherine, you've written about how First Amendment case history is filled with unsympathetic, disagreeable, and vicious litigants whose free speech claims prevailed. Can you shed some light on that? Give us examples of what themes you found in case law.
Sure. That's from my book, A Right to Lie, Presidents, Other Liars, and the First Amendment. And one of the reasons that we find unpleasant lead characters in these cases is the First Amendment is designed to protect the unpopular viewpoint, and many of the people expressing unpopular viewpoints are themselves very unpopular and are drawing fire in their communities. So that's how most of these cases arise. And that's why it's easy to say, you know, to those of us who don't watch Fox, as opposed to the devotees, Fox looks like a clearly evil character, and even more after we saw what was revealed in Discovery. So we have a man named Alanis who threatened his wife online, but did it in a very quote unquote clever way by saying, "I'm not allowed to say, go sit across from her house at X address and, you know, spy on her. I'm not allowed to say," and he goes on and on like that, but he never actually said. And one of the questions was his state of mind. We have people who are running around calling police fascists. We have very aggressive proselytizers who are harassing people outside and in their homes. And many of us would say, I would prefer not to encounter that person. I don't really want to see that person's or hear that person's speech. But the Supreme Court over and over for decades has reminded us that this First Amendment is not for the popular. And sometimes they call the people cantankerous mention that we are a disputatious society. And that's the speech that the First Amendment requires us to tolerate. We don't have to welcome it, but we cannot silence it. Another great example is the Westboro Baptist Church, a very small group of people who harassed veterans at their funerals. And in a very important speech case, the Supreme Court said, you know, as long as they didn't violate the laws about public gatherings, they have a right to do this, no matter how unpleasant their speech and hurtful.
David, picking up on that theme, are there constraints on First Amendment rights that the Supreme Court has allowed?
Well, there are some. I mean, first off, I think Professor Ross is correct that the part of the purpose of the First Amendment is to allow for unpopular and contrary speech, that quoting, you know, West Virginia versus Barnett, which is a very, very famous case, which actually involved, you know, mandatory flag saluting. At one point, you know, Justice Jackson says that, you know, nobody really has the right to define orthodoxy, you know, in our society. And that part of what a free society is about is limiting the circulation of a variety of opinions. But clearly there are some types of speech that are things that would say, let's say, communications that are not protected. For example, true threats. You know, the most obvious example would be, most immediate one, me putting a gun to your head and saying something to the effect of your money or your life. I mean, that's not a statement of free speech. You know, that's a threat. You know, we have situations in terms of what we would call like blackmail. The court has carved out areas such as, you know, obscenity and a few others. The point being is that not every utterance is given First Amendment protection. And the First Amendment is actually quite complex in terms of categories of speech, you know, when certain speech is allowed, when certain statements are not allowed, and so forth like that. But if I can just take about 30 seconds and back up, you know, part of what I want to argue is that unpopular is protected, lies are not protected. Mm-hmm. That there's this metaphor that really goes back to maybe John Stuart Mill, a famous philosopher in the 19th century, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, a justice, adopted it. William Brennan adopted it. The idea of the marketplace of ideas, that ideas compete against one another in search of the truth. And part of what that metaphor assumes is that there's a good faith effort on the part of people to put forth what they think are truthful statements, statements even of opinion that they want to support. And through that interplay of competition, we actually get to the discovery of the truth. And I say that because what I think the court is confusing now is the idea of the marketplace of ideas as a way of searching for truth, while at the same time asking the American public to try to figure out, what is the credibility? What is the truth content? Are these people being serious in terms of, and honest in terms of what they're doing? And we're asking the metaphor of the marketplace of ideas to do way too much in terms of helping us function as a democracy.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. We have this pair of legal scholars, Insights on First Amendment Rights and Protected Speech in America, David Schultz there of Hamline University, and Catherine Ross at George Washington Law School. Call in with your questions, how you view the current climate for speech, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we dig into these recent and not so recent examples testing freedom of speech with two legal scholars. Join in by calling along the way. Your questions and thoughts, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Schultz is a political science and legal studies professor at Hamline University. And Catherine Ross, law professor at George Washington University. Catherine, going back to the earlier aughts, this elected member of a water district board in California, Xavier Alvarez, lies about having received the Congressional Medal of Honor, was convicted under the U.S. Stolen Valor Act. Explain what happened in this case and perhaps connections to today.
Sure. And this is also responsive to something David said just before the break, in which he said lies are not protected. And part of the complexity of American First Amendment law, free speech law, is that things are much less clear than that. Until the Alvarez case, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 2012, many people thought that lies were outside the protection of the First Amendment, like defamation, obscenity, truth threats, and speech in connection with the commission of crimes. But the Supreme Court in that case said, not so fast. Alvarez was a habitual liar, described by his own lawyers as a habitual liar who lied about just about everything because he was a very insecure and troubled man. And after he was elected to this very minor local position, he told a lie, not only about having served in the military, but having won a Congressional Medal of Honor. And it was his bad luck that Congress had just passed a law that had not been tested in the courts yet, that was called the Stolen Valor Act, that made it illegal to, just a crime, to lie about having received one of the nation's highest honors, and those were listed. And then he told the lie in front of a woman who admired holders of high military honors more than she admired the biggest rock stars. Mm. And she did a little research and she tipped off the FBI. And so at his first meeting of the water board, when he was asked to introduce himself, he repeated the lie. It was recorded and he was prosecuted. And when this case reached the Supreme Court, on his First Amendment claim that he had a right to make these false claims about himself, the Supreme Court said for the first time, lies are within the confines of protected speech. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is, who is to decide what is true or false? Mm. And so they said, the government may not punish lies about these high honors or lies in general, unless it can show either harm to others or unfair benefit, I'm using my own language here to simplify, unfair benefit to the liar. So Congress rewrote that act to put in those requirements, and that is legal. But there were many, many questions that the Supreme Court left unresolved that I explore in my book. Among them, what is harm to others? And what is unfair benefit to the speaker? When are those conditions met? And equally important, and this is a little technical for generalist listeners, but in constitutional law, the outcome depends quite largely on what standard of review, what test the courts use.
Mm-hmm.
And the test generally used for free speech is called strict scrutiny. It is very, very hard for the government to win those cases. But the court left unclear whether that strict scrutiny standard or a lesser standard would apply when the government was defending its prosecution of lies. And that question, too, has never been answered. So lies are kind of protected, but they're not as protected as other kinds of speech. And they're not as unprotected as what we call the categorical exceptions to the speech clause, like defamation.
Naturally, we want to ask David about U.S. Congressman George Santos of New York, exposed by the New York Times for telling numerous lies about his resume and background. What, you know, what connections do you see here? What could government authorities do to prevent or punish a politician for being deceptive?
Well, first off, this is sort of the core area where I got interested in. I do teach, you know, constitutional law also. My main focus is on election law and on election lies, for example. So I just sort of mentioned it there. Now, what we would really ideally hope, I think, in a good world, is that lies like his would have been exposed at an earlier point and the public could have made a decision. I call it the political solution or the electoral solution to be able to address this. Now, in terms of, so that's would be ideal. But second, many states did have on the books for many years the rules regarding, you know, making lies during the campaign. The courts, the Supreme Court, this court has largely struck most of them down. Perhaps there's a way that what we could do is set up systems in terms of maybe either resuscitating those laws or setting up mechanisms for allowing for, let us say, opposing candidates if they lie about them to do something. Part of what I talk about in the piece on the Hill, there are not all lies are the same. Hmm. You know, there's lying about yourself, there's lying about an opponent, maybe there's lying about policy issues or position issues like that. Maybe they're stretching the truth. And I think what we also have to be thinking about here is what I'm going to call it different categories of lying, and might there be different remedies for trying to address them. But here, one would have hoped that the political process, that the media in New York would have exposed this. In fact, there's some evidence that I think at least one Long Island newspaper raised this issue at an early point, and it was largely ignored. So the Santos raises a lot of troubling questions about the role of, let's say, the commercial media. It raises questions about the integrity of candidates. And I wish I could give you an easy answer to say this is definitively what we should have done in that situation. But one is sort of hoping that the political solution exercises itself in 2024, where the voters get to say at this point, do we want to keep Santos or do we want to get rid of him? And how they judge veracity in terms of the issues that's important to them.
Catherine, what comes up for you with Santos?
Well, it's very problematic because, as I discuss in my book, there are still 16 states that have anti-lying statutes on their books. They are all clearly deficient were they to be tested in court. And there are many, many problems with enforcing them, including definitions, government censorship, who is the arbiter of truth, how big a lie is big enough. Some of them are phrased very, very broadly. Any misstatement could impact the outcome of the election. Is it whether you were wearing a blue suit or a gray suit? Is that a kind of lie that can be disciplined? And the timing, because often these challenges are put forward within a few days of the election. There's no time to resolve who is, whose claim is correct or incorrect. So I think that's a very difficult thing to do.
And we're going to pause right there with Catherine Ross, George Washington University law professor. David Schultz is here, Hamline University political science professor. Call in with questions and thoughts that surfaced for you at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine free speech rights guaranteed under the First Amendment and how these protections are being tested across America, like hate speech, lies, disinformation. Join in the conversation with legal scholars, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Catherine Ross is a law professor at George Washington University, wrote the book A Right to Lie. David Schultz is here, distinguished professor of political science and legal studies at Hamline University. Let's bring on a caller, Mike in Richland Center. Mike, what is your question?
Well, my question is pertaining to the some of the comments that have been brought up is who would be granted this ultimate right to assess and determine what is protected, what is not. My concern is that I've seen, even in the last couple of years, there's been more harm caused by restricting access to information than allowing free flow of information. And my take on this is, if you're raised in such a way as to feel murder or crime or whatever is wrong, you're not going to be easily swayed by somebody's lie to just go do that. However, if facts and that are allowed to be brought out, you can make an informed decision. You still have to live by your decision. But my concern is, it seems there's a drive for who gets to make that call. And it's not looking good. So what is your thoughts on how that gets determined?
Mike, thank you. David Schultz, you first.
Okay, a few different things here I want to sort of talk about here. Again, I referenced the idea of the marketplace of ideas. And unless you're a market fundamentalist in the economic market, many of us recognize that there can be unfair competition, that monopolies can form, that there can be a distortion of the marketplace, and we need to have regulation. And I would argue that we're finding the same place in the political or information marketplace at this point. What is it we now have? About six major companies in the United States that control approximately 92% of the media market in this country, both vertically and horizontally, commercial media market. I would argue that right now we already have a significant restriction upon the content of information. We have studies out of MIT that show that falsehoods travel further and circulate more rapidly in the social media. What I'm getting at here is that to a large extent, we already have a system where truth is being crowded out by falsity. And if to say that, well, we should completely rely upon an unregulated marketplace to sort it out, the answer is it's failing at this point. Now, in terms of who would sort this out, we let juries make decisions all the time regarding truth and falsity. The core job of juries is to what? Assess witness credibility, determine what the facts are. I am not saying we are going to turn this over to a censor whatsoever. What I'm arguing is that what we need to be thinking about here, what are the legal remedies following a fair legal process for helping to sort out truth versus fiction. And so many other areas of life, we police this. The last point I want to make here is that where I think the Supreme Court has gotten it wrong in the last few years is in privileging the position of the speaker in terms of being able to say whatever he or she wants, including a falsehood, as opposed to privileging the position of the public, the right of the public to receive truthful information. And that's where I would be starting to shift my emphasis, is in terms of saying structurally, for a democracy to work, we have to create structures that make it possible for the public to receive truthful information so they can vote, hold public officials accountable, et cetera, et cetera. Currently, legal doctrine does not make that possible.
And there's so much, Catherine, gray area there. I mean, if Facebook removes your post or Twitter deactivates your account or labels your organization state-affiliated media, I mean, do First Amendment protections apply? And how do you navigate then truth on the internet?
I agree with much of what David just said, and especially that this decline in truthfulness in public discourse is a huge problem moving forward for our democracy and for our elections. However, the First Amendment applies only to the government. It is the government that cannot restrict speech outside of the exceptions we've talked about. And much of what we're talking about here is done by private parties. And to be fair, some of them have really enormous outsized power. And the other part of that is the information silos that Americans live in today, where they get their news from very, very different sources that often have almost no overlap in what they cover or the information they provide or the slant that they put on that information. The problem is, it is true that juries are asked to distinguish fact from fiction or to vote on what is most persuasive in terms of truthfulness. And that certainly works in things like defamation trials. But for many of the lies that are being told in public that affect our election systems and our public discussions, which the court has reminded us time and again must be uninhibited and robust, which in some ways is another word for often impolite. Who is going to make those calls? And many, many courts, including opinions by Supreme Court justices, have pointed out that if the government gets in the business of distinguishing truth from falsehood, then it is Orwell's arbiter of truth. And we have an unacceptable, I mean, that goes to the heart of the First Amendment. The government cannot make those decisions. And when we're talking about lies, we also need to be very careful about what we sweep in to that definition, because legally a lie is something that the speaker knows to be untrue and expresses in the hope that others will believe it. And we should also limit ourselves to verifiable falsehoods. In other words, where we can establish as a matter of fact and beyond dispute that something is true or false. Like in traditional math, 2 + 2 = 4. And you can say, I think it's 5 as much as you want. It's not going to make it 5. But there are many areas that are grayer than that when we're talking about what is true and false. And there are also statements that nobody really expects will be believed. And that's another form of defense. So when you really start looking at how do we enforce regulations on telling the truth about certain things, it becomes extremely problematic.
Let's turn to Alex Jones, the podcaster ordered to pay $1.4 billion in damages to the families of the victims of Sandy Hook for spreading conspiracy theories about the mass shooting. Can civil lawsuits like this case be an effective way of keeping people honest, David?
It's certainly a tool, but again, at the end of the day, if we can bring the Alex Jones back to the Dominion lawsuit, you know, there's sort of an idea of saying that, okay, if somebody defames, if somebody lies, we're kind of hoping that the idea of saying that either lawsuits or more particularly financial payouts will serve as a deterrent to the speaker or as a deterrent to other speakers, other people out there who might do this. We know from the field of criminal justice that deterrence theory is at best problematic or at best weak in terms of being able to discourage people from committing crimes. I'm just not persuaded that at the end of the day, it's going to have much of an impact. Maybe it's sort of silences Alex Jones, takes him off the air. But for every Alex Jones, there's probably, I don't know, another 10, another 100 are out there. You shut down one Facebook site, another Facebook site shows up under a different pseudonym or a different, non-de-plume or something like that. So I'm not sure that the civil lawsuit process will in and of itself solve the issue. I mean, part of going back to when I said a culture of lying, again, there is this idea that there's a good faith belief that, we're going to good faith try to speak truthfully. Yeah, we can differ in our opinions. You know, if I happen to think that the world is flat, God bless me. That's my opinion or something like that. You know, but at the end of the day, I'm partly perplexed by how do we craft laws to encourage us to do what our grandmothers told us to do, which is to be truthful, honest, have a sense of integrity and respect. That's what we're trying to figure out how to do here. And again, I would like to try to get our laws and our structures to get us towards that. I recognize the problematic aspect of doing that.
David Schultz, Hamline University, Catherine Ross at George Washington School of Law, as we look at free speech and the First Amendment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You know, Catherine, Alex Jones's case was civil, not criminal, not about guilt or innocence. What effect does that have on truth?
Well, it changes the standards of proof. Mm-hmm. It's easier to win a civil case than a criminal prosecution. The courts are an instrument of the state, and so there is state involvement in enforcing that, but again, within an exception to general First Amendment principles, which is defamation law. And there, even if we were squarely within the First Amendment, there is no question that Alex Jones's false statements and repeated lies both harmed others, the families of the dead children, and enriched him. So even under the Supreme Court standard for when lies can be regulated, that's a really easy case in my book. Many of the cases are, of course, much harder to pin down. It was extreme cases are kind of easy to draw lines around. I do want to say that I am not hopeless about doing something about lies. I don't believe that the First Amendment, the speech clause, is part of a suicide pact, to paraphrase an often quoted statement. The Constitution is not a suicide pact. And I think if we work carefully and craft with skill and with attention to the doctrine, there are still things that we could do to rein in lies.
And I'm going to turn to you, David, in just a moment to hear about your signs of hope. We have legal scholars Catherine Ross at George Washington University, David Schultz at Hamline, guides to free speech protections, how they're being tested, and where we go from here. Still time to bring your questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Ready to join the conversation at work by starting your day with WPR's new weekday morning podcast, Wisconsin Today. You'll hear the trusted WPR news coverage you've come to rely on in one quick listen. Find Wisconsin Today wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.
Today at 11 on the Larry Miller Show, hey, it's time to change out your snow tires. We catch up on vehicle maintenance with a former service manager from Smart Motors of Madison. Join with your questions at 11 on the Larry Miller Show.
All of us want to know what's going on, but only some of us want to know the why. That's where we come in. 1A is a place for the curious. Daily conversations for those looking to make sense of our world. I'm Jen White. I hope you'll join me next time for 1A.
This morning at 9 on the Ideas Network.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with two legal scholars exploring developments in free speech protections and where it goes from here. Number to call in, 800-642-1234. Your questions welcome. Catherine Ross is a law professor at George Washington University, and David Schultz, political science and legal studies professor at Hamline University. Let's go to Kay in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi, how are you all?
Doing well.
It's a lively debate.
Yes.
I would like to, I'm a Civil War historian, and I would like your guest comment on my research on Lincoln's making arrests for what people sometimes have considered only speech, but it wasn't. The first case was as southern states were seceding. Late in the game in August, he arrested members of the Maryland state legislature. He later wrote a public letter stating that he did not arrest these men. It was 55 men out of 88, as I remember, for just what they thought in terms of secession. But because they were leaders, the armed insurrection going on in Maryland, that was members of which were tearing up railroad track down telegraph lines to prevent state militia, other northern state militia from reaching Washington. The second case was he arrested a few publishers whose opinion was that they had opposed the draft. But Lincoln said it was not just what they thought about the draft, is because they were urging soldiers to desert because they had been drafted. So he said, why should I not touch a hair on the head of a publisher when I am forced to decide which Union, young Union soldiers to shoot because they had deserted because of these publishers?
Kay, thank you so much. Catherine Ross, the Civil War, in light of where we are today, go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Kay. I actually also hold a PhD in history, and I love to integrate this history into my con law classes. So there is a very important distinction between conduct and speech. And we often have to look at acts that combine aspects of speech and of conduct pursuant to that speech. When we're talking about conduct that is illegal, there is no protection, even if it is surrounded by speech. And those are good, if still controversial, examples. So when we look at things like, was there incitement to riot on or to commit illegal acts on January 6th? I've argued, yes, there was incitement and people can be held accountable for that. That is not protected by the First Amendment. And similarly, other acts of violence pursuant to belief in election laws. We do not have to tolerate a level of illegality and violence because it is pursued under the guise of an idea. Ideas and speech are intended to have consequences. And so too, the illegal acts pursuant to those ideas should have consequences, and people should be forced to take responsibility.
Kay, thank you for the call. Ryan in Madison. Ryan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick comment that, you know, with the normal qualifiers of, you know, like the previous caller just said, you know, about illegal speech and incitement or yelling fire and cry out of the theater, I think free speech should more or less be an absolute right, and we shouldn't be looking to make additional laws to curtail that. And it's really up to the responsibility of the citizens to exercise that right properly. And, you know, I'm concerned about free speech in today's day and age, especially, you know, with the Twitter files coming out showing how the government, the federal government, requested social media companies to either take down tweets or accounts or, you know, review them in accordance with their rules. And I know, like, I just saw a story, I think, on the Canadian Broadcasting Company yesterday that there's something similar to that potentially in Canada. So,
Ryan, thank you. And I want David Schultz to jump in here. David.
Sure. First off, I should say that I still believe at the end of the day that people have a right to believe whatever they want, regardless of how unpopular they have. I agree with Catherine Ross's reading of the doctrine also, that once we cross over from ideas, you know, into conduct, depending on what the conduct is, clearly, you know, some conduct is acceptable. Some of it could cross over to the criminal grounds. So I don't want anybody to walk away thinking that, you know, I'm advocating censorship. I'm not. What I'm advocating is saying that we have to think about the structural rules for democracy, the rules of engagement, about the ability of the public to be able to make critical decisions and sort out truth and falsity. Saying that, what I also find interesting is for many people who distrust the government in terms of an arbiter of truth, place enormous faith in the private sector and in private corporate power that it's going to do the right thing. I don't know about you. I am far more afraid of Facebook, Twitter, of Amazon, of Google with their algorithms in terms of how they're structuring and in many ways affecting the flow of information in our society. And I think we need to be thinking about that. We need to be thinking about how private power clearly constrains and affects how we think about things. The whole purpose of advertising is to convince us to buy things that we don't want to buy. It is to mold our opinions, to mold our views. We forget about the insidious power of information in private hands.
David, in our last moments together, though, what are your signs of hope in this fraught constitutional frontier?
You know, I would like to be an optimist right now. given the direction of the Supreme Court, which I hate to use the phrase, is weaponizing the First Amendment and privileging like an Alvarez and so forth opinions, the right to lie. I'm not overly optimistic, but if I were looking in directions for what to do, I do think we need to be thinking about ways of perhaps applying more vigorous antitrust laws to the social media. I think in terms of ownership, I think we need to do a much, much better job in terms of educating people about civic education, sorting out fact from fiction. If I could wave my magic wand, it certainly doesn't cover everything. I would bring back the fairness doctrine. Mm. I don't think there's any one silver bullet. And I think the task is very, very difficult right now. I was talking earlier, I gave a lecture to a class in Ukraine early this morning, talking about what? The Russian attempts to try to affect U.S. elections. And these are challenges in terms of how social media and the internet are really challenging our ability to sort out fact from fiction, lies from truth.
Thank you both for joining us. David Schultz, distinguished professor at Hamline University. Catherine Ross, law professor at George Washington University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.